This week I'm joined by Stuart Eldon, who is a Professor of Political Theory and Geography at the University of Warwick. He is the author of multiple books on the work of Michel Foucault, alongside other texts on Georges Canguilhem, Kant and Heidegger. In this episode we discuss his soon-to-be-published book, The Early Foucault. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you would like to support Hermetics Podcast or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy.
So, Stuart Eldon, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We are going to be discussing the third book. Sort of, is it officially a series?
Effectively. Yeah, it has become one. Yeah.
So, on the work of Michel Foucault. So, Foucault, The Birth of Power, and Foucault's Last Decade War are the two other texts. But we are going to be discussing the very, very rarely discussed early Foucault, roughly sort of 50s through to 1960, because History of Madness is published in 1961, which is where basically everyone else begins. And for the research, it made me laugh. For the research for this, I reread Dreyfus and Rabineau's Beyond Structuralism and Hermeneutics. And straight after the introduction, it really made me laugh. It just says, I think the first line it says, "So we begin with the history of madness." So, and instantly you're thinking, okay, so what happened? You know, how did we get here? So it's an interesting question. But before we jump into early Foucault and Foucault's thought, just tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps not why you wrote this book, but why you wrote this series.
Right, thank you. I suppose in terms of the series, I didn't imagine it was going to be a series at the beginning. I wanted to write the book on Foucault's last decade. I thought that there was an interesting story to tell about how the Collège de France courses, which were not all published at the time I began that work, but how those courses gave a kind of sort of parallel story to the publications that Foucault did in his lifetime. And I thought, you know, these courses can tell or fill in some details of a story about Foucault's intellectual development in that period. And towards the end of writing that book, and this is a common theme with me, the book was far too long. And so I went to the publisher and said, you know, you can either have a much longer book, probably 50% longer than the contract, or I can take the initial chapter, which looks at the period before that last decade, the early 70s, I can take that out and make that as the basis for another book, which is what becomes the Birth of Power book, which effectively looks at how does Foucault go from the archaeology of knowledge in 1969 to Discipline and Punish, Suvir Punir in 1975. So one book became two. I mean, I had to do a lot more work when I decided that it was going to become two books because I went and did a lot more archival work and so on to fill out that earlier story. And then this kind of left this question of, okay, do you go back and do the period before? And we'll maybe come back to the sort of thinking of that period before and how that's developed into what will be two books. There'll be a book on roughly the 1950s and a book on the 1960s. So yeah, the Foucault work has grown and developed. It's exceeded any boundaries I kind of put it. But by the time I began the third, I knew there would be a fourth and that the four in total would complete the series. But that wasn't the original intention when I thought I was going to write the book on the last decade.
Okay, so what was sort of the reasons for that? Was it just there was too much to tell, or was there specific ideas you wanted to get across?
I suppose a bit of both. The amount of material is now enormous, and particularly for the 1970s and the 1980s, we now have all of Foucault's lecture courses from that period, give or take a few that were done outside of France that are due to be published on what still exists. All of that material is now published. The History of Sexuality, Volume 4, is now available. It wasn't when I was writing Foucault's Last Decade, but that's now available. And I think that 70s and 80s material has changed how we think about Foucault's work, about his intellectual development, about how the books are obviously crucial moments in that, but the silences or the gaps between them were filled with a lot of lecturing, a lot of occasional pieces, a lot of things that he chose not to publish, drafts and so on. And so there's an enormous amount of material, and we'll maybe talk about the archives as we go through this discussion. And then with the earlier period, I credit a friend of mine, Mark Kelly, who's somebody else who's written on Foucault and political philosophy particularly. And I remember a conversation with Mark after I'd finished The Birth of Power, and he said, you know, what's next? And I said, well, probably a book on the 1960s to do that thing of, you know, history of madness through to the archaeology of knowledge. And Mark said, and I remember it very clearly, a book on the 1950s would be much more interesting. And my initial reaction was, there's not enough material to write a whole book on that period. In the 1950s, Foucault doesn't publish very much. There's a short book that he later disowns. There's a couple of commissioned book chapters for collections. There's the long introduction to the Binswanger translation and a couple of other pieces, but really not very much. But then as I sort of started thinking about it and thought, okay, there's some interesting stuff in the archives from that period that's not yet been published. And I thought, maybe there is a book on this, and really a book about how Foucault came to write The History of Madness. So The History of Madness is where this book ends, whereas, as you said, and the Dreyfus and Rabinow one is a good example, that's where a lot of books on Foucault begin. Mm-hmm. So more and more material, and we'll talk more about that, but there were, you know, texts that I didn't know existed when I started writing this book that I've now got quite substantial discussions of, or texts that I knew of but didn't know still existed that I also have discussions of. And I just kept finding more and more material in Foucault's archives, in the archives of his research collaborators or his mentors or other figures. And the story just got more and more complicated as I was trying to tell it. So.
Okay. So it's like a deep dive into the archives, which I understand are sort of immense in their scope. But before we go sort of deep into early Foucault, I do have to ask you the hermetics question, which is, you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick? As we're talking about Foucault, we can sort of include him and then include three others, if you like, if you want Foucault there.
Well, yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, the obvious example would be the thinkers that I've worked on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my PhD was on Nietzsche, Heidegger and Foucault. I've worked a lot on Henri Lefebvre, but I actually wonder whether the more interesting conversations will be ones that actually happened, but just to be the sort of, you know, the fly on the wall in those. So conversations between Sartre and de Beauvoir and Merleau-Ponty in the early days of Les Temps Modernes, or when Georges Bataille put together the Critique Journal in the early days with Eric Weil and Jean Peel, or when Peel took over after Bataille's death and Foucault, Derrida and Barthes were on the editorial board. And, you know, we know the Sartre and de Beauvoir, you know, all these conversations in cafes kind of thing, but the meetings of Critique happened over dinners that they had. And, you know, just the idea of just being there and seeing that intellectual project of those journals being put together, I think that would be fascinating.
Okay. So you wouldn't sort of utilise the room to sort of annoy a figure. It would be more to witness history.
Yeah, I suppose so, because so much of the sort of the history that I'm trying to write is of that post-war French period. And, you know, what's extraordinary, I get this with my students, is saying, you know, they all knew each other. It's not that they were these, you know, detached figures who were disconnected, is that because so much of French intellectual life is concentrated on Paris, and many of them were teachers or colleagues or friends or lovers or whoever, you know, and these close-knit intellectual connections. And a lot of really good work, I think, has been done about that period. But there's just so many open questions of things that don't have a textual basis that would be interesting to be able to overhear and to, you know, think about what actually happened in that setting.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good use of the room. Okay, so maybe some of this sort of that idea of, you know, the networked post-war French period will come back in. But moving into early Foucault, you mentioned the archives. How did you sort of approach... Sorry, I am already going off the questions a little bit here. How did you actually sort of approach doing the research for, you know, how does one find the research when going into it knowing there isn't going to be much of this? This is going to be difficult. Was it tough to find, you know, what you were looking for here?
At times it was difficult. There are occasional sort of hints that something might have existed at some point, and where that ended up can be a complicated question. the background to this, I suppose, is it's maybe worth saying, is that Daniel Defer, who was Foucault's life partner, sold the Foucault papers that were left in Foucault's apartment when he died. He sold them to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. I think it was in 2013. And it's 37,000 pages of material in that archive. And this is some draft manuscripts. So the History of Sexuality, Volume 4 is in there. There's other draft texts to varying degrees of some of Foucault's books, although Foucault didn't often keep the draft. Once the book was published, he quite often discarded the draft material. But there's all of Foucault's reading notes. So the notes that he took when he was in the libraries or archives or wherever doing his own research. And there's Foucault's lecture notes for courses that he taught in Paris or elsewhere. So there's an enormous amount of material. And when I started working on it, only some boxes were listed in the catalogue. And now those boxes seem to all be available to people doing research on this. So with part of this, it was just, well, how much time do I need in Paris to sort of work through this? And so whenever I've been able to in sort of reading weeks or teaching vacations or other times, I've just gone to Paris and spent as much time as I can, you know, getting to the library when it opened in the morning and leaving when it closes, and just working through the material and building up a kind of a almost like an inventory of my own of what's there, so that then when I later think, oh, but I've seen something about that, I can find in my big, you know, notes file where it might be and know where to go back to and so on. So some of it is that enormous quantity of material. There's a couple of other archives that the BNF also has. One is one that's been there available for years, but hasn't actually been very widely used, which is a draft of The Archaeology of Knowledge, an early draft manuscript, and the draft material for History of Sexuality, Volumes 2 and 3, where you can see Foucault's working versions of successive drafts of each chapter, and the old-fashioned cut and paste, where you cut up a manuscript typed page and paste it onto a new sheet and then write the linking part and then give that back to a typist who would then type the next version of it. And so you can see the kind of materiality of how Foucault put texts together. And that's unusual, because, as I said, Foucault didn't tend to keep that draft material. But with History of Sexuality 2 and 3, he died so close to their publication, he clearly didn't have time to discard that material that was still in. He was in hospital when the books were published. So there was that. And then there's another archive that hasn't even been catalogued yet, which is papers that were in Foucault's mother's house.
Wow.
Which Foucault's nephew donated to the Bibliothèque Nationale. And that's material from quite early through to roughly the mid-1950s. And so for this early Foucault book, that was fascinating to go through, because there's all sorts of really interesting material in there, but there's also a whole lot of kind of rubbish, like sort of just bits and pieces thing, you know, Foucault's papers. So, you know, insurance for his car, his Communist Party membership cards, you know, these kinds of bits and pieces of things that he'd clearly kept and had left in his mother's house, I think probably when he moved to Uppsala in 1955, and probably never looked at again from the state of the material. It didn't look like anyone's gone through and sort of sifted it. There's quite a lot of correspondence in that material, which isn't there in the later archives. So that was another source that I used quite a lot for this early book. And so with some of this, it was just, there's so much material. How do you find a way through it rather than the complications of finding a source for something? But there were other things where I knew something existed, and it took quite a lot of hunting before I could find, you know, a scrap of evidence that I could put together with something else to try and build up the story.
Were there clear thinkers or ideas that were coming through which you sort of thought, okay, I can sort of begin from here, this is the direction that Foucault's taking at this point in time? Or was it constructed in a completely different manner?
He files his reading notes, and this is from all periods, but he files his reading notes thematically. And sometimes those are by thinker. So there's a box of material on German philosophy, for example, which has got notes on Nietzsche and on Heidegger and on Husserl and others. Some of it is on themes that then we know he talked about in lecture courses or that clearly informed the writing of some of his more famous books. But that material is quite difficult to work with because Foucault doesn't date things. And because he files thematically, he moves material around as he's working. Clearly, these are notes for his use, not for, you know, a future historian to look at. So he mixes up material from quite different periods, sometimes in the same folder, as he maybe goes back to material from History of Madness or Birth of the Clinic in the 1970s, when he's lecturing on material that connects to that, but sort of rethinking it through his new concepts and so on. So there were a lot of moments when I was really hesitant to try and make claims, because it's kind of, you could be just completely misled by how this material has been rearranged. And clearly other hands have touched this material in between Foucault and me, the Daniel Defere or the archivists or other researchers. And so that I was very careful with how I worked with material, but occasionally I'd go back to a box and find things in a slightly different order, or a page that was back to front had been flipped around the right way. And so I was always very hesitant about that in terms of working with things and making bold claims on the basis of what was in those. So some of it, yes, thinker-based. And the Nietzsche and Heidegger notes, Foucault in a very late interview talks about, you know, Nietzsche and Heidegger, they were really important for me, and I still have the notes, and there are tons of them. And until now, nobody had, you know, or very few people had been able to see these, but I have now actually seen those notes, and they are really extensive. So that was very interesting for me to, you know, to see something that Foucault had mentioned late in life, and it was important when I wrote my PhD in the 1990s, but it was only in the, what was it, 2014, probably 2015, that I first actually saw those notes, and to see what Foucault actually took as reading notes when he was working on that stuff.
It's funny you mentioned Heidegger, actually, because Heidegger is someone I'd written down, because I remember listening to a lecture by Dreyfus on Heidegger, where he mentions, you know, Heidegger for Foucault was this huge influence. And it's only, I think this might be completely wrong, but I think Dreyfus even says that on his deathbed, Foucault finally sort of admits to the fact that he has been in this conversation with Heidegger for, you know, this might be a bit dramatized, but for his career. And it doesn't really come through much of the time. So is this era where Foucault's sort of, you can't avoid these clear influences he has, and he isn't hiding them away anymore, and this is where he's sort of beginning, and then he finally moves off into his own thing without sort of drawing them in and quoting them directly, so to speak?
Yeah, and Foucault does this with quite a lot of thinkers. I mean, Marx is the other one where Marx informs a lot of Foucault's work, particularly Marx as a historian, but Foucault often doesn't, you know, explicitly cite Marx, or some of the early 1970s lectures where Bernard Arcour, who's been editing some of those early 70s lectures, has sort of said, you know, there's a hidden dialogue going on here with E.P. Thompson, the English historian. So there are moments where Foucault's in dialogue with people where he doesn't explicitly mention it. The Heidegger relation, I mean, that was the claim of my PhD, which became my first book, which was about that relation between Heidegger and Foucault and how Heidegger's reading of Nietzsche was very important to Foucault. And I, as I said, I made those claims then on the basis of what publications there were by Foucault, rather than any access to notes or any kind of the material that I've been able to access now. So I would still hold to a lot of the claims I made there about how important Heidegger was. And I talk about Heidegger and Nietzsche in this new book on the early Foucault through that way that Foucault is reading and engaging with those thinkers. What I hadn't realized back in the 90s when I wrote my PhD in that first book, I hadn't realized quite how important some of Foucault's teachers were in terms of introducing him to those thinkers. So Jean Val, for example, gave extensive lecture courses on Heidegger that Foucault certainly attended some of. And as with many of the people that Foucault was taught by, they were significant enough thinkers that their lectures have been published either on the basis of their own manuscripts or on student transcripts. So Jean Val was one of Foucault's teachers. On Hegel, Jean Hippolyte was one. Jean Beaufray, taught Foucault mainly on the history of philosophy, but Jean Beaufré was somebody that Heidegger knew because Heidegger's Letter on Humanism was written in response to questions that Jean Beaufré had asked him. So Foucault was certainly part of an intellectual circle where Heidegger was not very far away. And he did really read Heidegger extensively. There are, I mean, some of the notes in Holzweger, the kind of wood paths or timber tracks would be an English translation of the title. They're sort of paths that lead into the forest but don't necessarily go anywhere. And Foucault takes, you know, 30 pages of handwritten notes on a single essay from that collection. So when Foucault says, you know, there are tons of notes on Heidegger, he's not wrong. The argument will then come about, you know, so how is Heidegger important? How does that shape some of Foucault's thinking and so on? So some of the things we might talk about when Foucault's engaging with Binswanger, for example, we might touch again on the Heidegger thing, but there is now a lot of material on that Heidegger Foucault relation that I think, or in Foucault's reading of Heidegger that I think informs that debate.
Yeah, so my next question was, you know, how does this era sort of alter the way we understand Foucault? But that's quite a big question. So I think perhaps to focus on the work of Ludwig Binswanger, which is one of those few texts or introductions, this extensive introduction that we have, that's one of the few things which is left in sort of a complete form. So what is Foucault's sort of, should we say, relationship with Binswanger? And why do you think that doesn't really carry forward explicitly?
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems that Foucault taught Binswanger in Lille. So in the early 1950s, he had a teaching position at the University of Lille where he was teaching psychology to philosophy students. So psychology wasn't a separate department. It was the teaching in psychology was done within the philosophy department. And so Foucault was a fairly obvious person to appoint for this because he had both an interest in psychology and philosophy and had been trained in both disciplines. And so it seems likely that Foucault taught Binswanger to his students there. And as you said, there's that long introduction to the translation of Binswanger's Dream and Existence. And the translation is credited to Jacqueline Verdot, but it seems that Foucault worked with her quite extensively on there. And the correspondence that Verdot has with Binswanger and with Roland Kuhn, who was a colleague of Binswanger's in Switzerland, the correspondence that they have suggests kind of the very active role that Foucault had in that translation, particularly over the philosophical terminology, and within that, especially around Heideggerian terms, because relatively little Heidegger was translated in French at this time. This is in the mid-1950s. So we knew about that introduction and the translation, and there's a couple of notes in the original version of the translation that are clearly Foucault's that explain some of the terminology and how they've chosen to render the German into French. So I discuss all of that in the book and spend quite a lot of time on analysing the German and the French text together and kind of how did they get from this phrase in the German to this phrase in the French terms and so on. But there's also a big manuscript on Binswanger that exists in the archive. And it was actually due to be published this year. Elisabetta Basso, who's written some very important work on Foucault in the 1950s and particularly his relation to psychology, Elisabetta was going to edit this or has edited this text, but the publication's been delayed because of the pandemic. But this is a much longer text than the introduction to the Dream and Existence translation. And it's Foucault trying to read Binswanger through, particularly through his case studies of his patients. Binswanger publishes a number of those in a book called Schizophrenia. And Foucault's interested in how Binswanger can move from a kind of a phenomenological description of those individual cases to use that to explore kind of the deeper ontological structures of being, particularly around space and time. And it's an interesting text, and it seems that Foucault had quite a lot of material on Binswanger for teaching or for this writing, that then when he's asked to write this introduction to a text he's helped to co-translate, he already had a very detailed knowledge of Binswanger that he was then able to use to write this introductory text for that publication. He met Binswanger at least twice, There were two visits to Switzerland with Jacqueline Vaudeau and her husband Georges Vaudeau and Foucault in 1954, where they discussed the work that they were doing and what future work there might be, of whether they would go on and translate some of these case studies on patients. And Jacqueline Vaudeau does go on and translate one of the case studies by Binswanger, and then later edits a book of translations of Binswanger's essays into French. But Foucault seems to sort of break off these relations around 1955 when he moves to Uppsala, and his work goes in quite different directions from that point on. So there was a connection. There's some correspondence between Foucault and Binswanger, some of which has been published and some of which is in the Binswanger archive, which is in Tübingen in Germany. So there's an interesting story, I think, to tell about that connection he has to Binswanger, but it's one that does seem to come to an end around 1955. So he's only involved really in that one translation. But then Vaudeau continues to work with Binswanger for a while afterwards.
Okay. So alongside this Binswanger translation, there is also these manuscripts from Foucault on Hegel, Husserl and Kant from this era. So there is a connection here of phenomenology, and of course Foucault moves beyond phenomenology in the subject-object relation. So do you think that the reason he sort of didn't want these things published, or the way in which he moved, because he'd moved beyond phenomenology in that sort of, wrong use of the word, but classical understanding of it, that's why he didn't really want these things published, is because his relationship with phenomenology wasn't one where he sort of agreed with it?
Maybe. I suppose I would approach a question about why he didn't publish some of those manuscripts more sort of historically.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the development of his work and what he chose to publish and so on. So maybe if I go through those manuscripts in turn, because they come from different periods. So the Hegel one is his diploma thesis from 1949, which was something that we knew just the title until relatively recently, and everybody thought it was lost because Foucault didn't keep a copy himself. So it wasn't in the papers that de Fer sold, but it was in the papers that Foucault's nephew found in Foucault's mother's house. And that seems to be the only extant copy of this. So this was written when Foucault was 22. It's kind of like a master's thesis by research. It's something like that sort of type qualification and level. And it's a text that Foucault writes under the supervision of Jean Hippolyte, so the Hegel translator and scholar. And it's a really interesting text to read, and I have a discussion of it in the book, but it's very much a kind of an apprentice work, and like a lot of people, you know, you don't always want to publish your master's thesis. And I suspect that Foucault didn't think it was worth publishing at the time, and he was moving on in terms of his own training, you know, going on to do the aggregation and then become a teacher. And in, as I said, in Lille, he also taught at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. So it seems like it was a text that Foucault wrote because he needed to write a thesis for his diploma thesis. And then he just didn't return to it. It's quite a different text in terms of its approach. It's much more, you know, because it's focused on a single thinker, which is unusual for Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more tied to the text and to some degree, the context, but it's quite an internal argument about the text. So it's on the constitution of the transcendental in Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. It's quite a complicated text, but it shows that Foucault had really done the work on Hegel, and that working with Hippolyte, that would make sense in that, you know, he's working with France's kind of foremost Hegel scholar at the time on this. The one I've called in the book, the Husserl text, it's the title that Foucault gives it is Phenomenology and Psychology,
mm-hmm.
but it quickly becomes a text that is almost exclusively on Husserl. And he seems to have written this, again, it's not dated, but he seems to have written this around sort of 1954, 55, something like that period. And he mentions a text in a letter to Georges de Maizière when he's trying to get the job in Uppsala, And this sounds like that's the text that he has in mind when he mentions this in correspondence, and even his CV that he submits to Uppsala to get this teaching job. And it's an interesting text, and Foucault's interested in the question of the world, and he's reading Husserl in quite a lot of detail. There are reports that he was working in the Husserl archives, because Husserl's archival material, the main archive is in Louvain in Belgium, but there's also a copy of it at the ENS, the Economie Supérieure in Paris, and so Foucault was working with that. And I found correspondence that Foucault wrote to the German publisher of one of Husserl's essays, the Philosophy as a Rigorous Science, and asked for the translation rights. And seems that, you know, that Husserl could have easily become a future trajectory for Foucault in terms of his work, a bit like it was for Derrida a few years later. A lot of Derrida's early work is about or in dialogue with Husserl. But Foucault seems to have abandoned that. He doesn't do the translation. Quentin Lauer publishes the translation of that Husserl essay in French. And Foucault seems to leave that behind. And I'd suggest, again, it's when he goes to Uppsala that a lot of this early work seems to have been left behind as he starts the work for what becomes the History of Madness. The Kant manuscript is of a later date. I guess a lot of people will know this, but Foucault has to submit a secondary thesis. The History of Madness is only his primary thesis for his doctoral degree. And it's not a PhD, it's at a higher level of doctorate than that, but Foucault submits the History of Madness as his primary thesis, and then a translation of Kant's Anthropology and an introduction is his secondary thesis. And Foucault then goes on and publishes the translation of the Anthropology in 1964, but only with a short historical note, which is taken from the longer thesis introduction, but in 64 he only publishes a short part of it. That full introduction, which was available in archives for quite a while, was published probably about 10 years ago. So that Kant text has been published and has been available for a while. I mean, I discussed that in the book, although that's one of the texts that has been available from this period. But the reason I don't think he publishes that is because, in a sense, that's a kind of a very preliminary sketch of some of the ideas that he'll explore in The Order of Things. And by 1964, when he publishes the Kant translation, he's already well underway in writing, well, in French it's Les Mots et les Choses, but in English the translation is The Order of Things. And he says in the historical note to the Kant translation, this topic of philosophical anthropology will be explored in a future work. And by that, he clearly means Les Mots et les Choses. So the Kant introduction for Foucault, in a sense, is a kind of preliminary step towards what becomes a book. I mean, not entirely. There's a lot of material specifically on Kant that he doesn't have in that book, but some of the themes in that continue into that publication. So that's why I said with the three texts, the Hegel, the Husserl, and the Kant, they come from the late 40s, I think the mid 50s, and the late 50s to early 60s. And that's partly why they have different sort of histories in Foucault's work.
Okay. You've mentioned Uppsala quite a few times. It seems that this is an extremely important event for Foucault. Do you think this, you know, it seems that when you've mentioned it, that a lot of currents that he's working with suddenly sort of stop when this happens. Why do you think it's so important, and when is this as well?
Right, so he starts teaching there in 1955. And he teaches three academic years at the University of Uppsala. And while he's teaching, and he's also running the cultural program of the local French Institute in the Maison de France in Uppsala. So he's doing things that are not connected to his own writing and work. So he directs some plays, French one-act plays that are performed there. There's a lot of film screenings where he'd lead discussions. He invites quite a lot of interesting people to come and give lectures in Uppsala. And he also gives public lecture courses, but he's also teaching at the university as well, teaching mainly French literature. And Uppsala is an important moment, but I don't want to overstate this, because one of the things about the Uppsala moment is that there seems to me to be quite a detailed archival record of before Uppsala, which is mainly in these papers that are in that were left in the mother's house and that are now at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and then a relatively limited archive of the later 50s, so after the move to Uppsala, which may simply be down to the fact that Foucault's travelling, and so he doesn't have the ability to keep everything and to bring everything with him. It also seems to be partly to do with how he teaches. Some of the reports suggest that a lot of the teaching was improvised or was from the basis of relatively few notes. So there may not be that, there may never have been the lecture notes that I would love to have found on his courses on French literature and so on. But I think Uppsala is important for other reasons. I think that this is the moment when Foucault starts the work that becomes the history of madness. And the stories, the biographies tend to tell the story about how Foucault discovers the riches of the Carolina Rediviva, which is the main library in Uppsala University, and particularly a collection that had been bequeathed by a private collector in the history of medicine. That's a slightly misleading story because Foucault doesn't use that collection, I think, as much as people have suggested. I actually spent very long days in Uppsala working with the catalogue and the bibliography of the History of Madness and seeing whether the editions that Foucault references were actually in that collection at that library. And it's actually a very small percentage of Foucault's references that are actually in that collection. But I think it probably inspired him as a place to work. And he certainly wrote a lot of the book while he was in Uppsala. The other figure, which I've increasingly realized is important in this story, is Georges de Mazille, who helped Foucault get the job in Uppsala. He made the introduction, and de Mazille had held that post in the 1930s. And so his former colleagues in Uppsala asked him for a recommendation for somebody to teach this French literature in the French cultural program. And de Mazille asked around and eventually suggested Foucault to them. Foucault meets de Mazille at this time and starts reading his work. And de Mazille's work, which is mainly in linguistics, but also in the history of religions and the history of mythology particularly. And Foucault seems to have found that work quite important for his own thinking, even though he's working on quite different subject matter. I think he finds something of de Mazille's approach helpful. And there's references to de Mazille start to come up in some of Foucault's writings, published or unpublished from around that time. So I think de Mazille is important. There's also the Nietzsche and Heidegger reading, which he'd started when he was in Paris, started in a very serious way, I think, when he was in Paris, probably around 1954, 55, and starts to come through in some of his teaching around that time before he leaves France. So I think there's a whole set of reasons that he moves out of France and teaches different material. His encounter with de Mazille, I think, is important. His engagement with Nietzsche and Heidegger is important. But most importantly, he's writing the History of Madness, and starts to sort of throw away quite a lot of the material that he published beforehand, or discard some of the sort of conceptual frameworks that he'd used beforehand, and starts off in a quite different direction.
Okay. You said it was sort of a shame that you couldn't find any or much archive material on his notes on French literature. This is something that seems to be understated in his work as well. It's sort of understood that, you know, I mentioned Beckett in the questions, that he had this sort of epiphantic experience with Beckett. I think there's one other cited, some book, I can't remember which, but he has this relationship with literature. So is this something, was there some archival material which helped form an understanding of Foucault with literature, or was it slim pickings?
So there are materials on literature, but they're mainly of a later period to the one I was working on for this book. And so for the book that I'm now writing, which is on Foucault in the 1960s, there's quite a lot of material on literature that I want to discuss. Foucault publishes quite a lot on literature in the 1960s, particularly in the first half of the decade. But there's also quite a lot of material that's been published after his death. And various collections have brought together some of those texts, which are both on the sort of the classical figures of French literature, so Balzac and Flaubert, for example, but also on quite a lot of contemporary to Foucault, 20th century writers. And of course, in the 60s, there's also the book on Raymond Roussel, and a whole set of essays for journals like Critique and Telcal. And so literature is really important to Foucault, published and unpublished. When I was talking about material that doesn't exist. I was meaning when Foucault was teaching French literature in the 1950s, both in Uppsala and then in the post he had in Warsaw and then the one in Hamburg. There seems to be very little material that might have been used in a classroom that still exists. But there are some of Foucault's reading notes on, not so much literature, because I suspect with a lot of these, he owned the physical book. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the notes that Foucault took, his reading notes, seem to be of things that he was reading in libraries where he didn't own the book, but he was taking notes for later use. But I think when he owns a copy of a book, he doesn't take such extensive notes. And I suspect that may be part of the reason with the literature for how he goes on in the later work. So yeah, Beckett he mentions as an important experience for him. Literature generally, Daniel Defer in various interviews talks about how much Foucault was reading literature sort of as a regular thing that he was building into his sort of daily routine, rather than something that he only got to sort of, you know, on holiday or something like that. It's clear that Foucault was reading literature of a wide range continually. But art, so painting particularly, was also important to Foucault. That comes through particularly in the 1960s. But music is another one that's important in terms of sort of Foucault's engagement with the arts. Foucault was in a relation with Jean Baraquet, who was a modernist composer in the mid-1950s. And that, I'm not so interested in the personal relationship, the, you know, the lovers and why they broke up and so on. But that's sort of covered in some of Didier Erebon's work, and Paul Griffiths, who wrote a biography of Baraquet, talk about that. I was more interested in the intellectual side of the relation. And there's some interesting things about that, I think, that Foucault was giving texts by Nietzsche to Baraquet, who was then setting them to music. Or there's Baraquet's major compositional work, which was unfinished when he died. He died very young. But his major compositional work was around Herman Brock's novel, The Death of Virgil, which Foucault had read and then gave to Baraquet and suggested that this might help him to structure the compositions that he was doing. So there are some Baraquet papers that I was able to look at. There's some private material that I haven't yet been able to look at. But there's some interesting material there in that kind of relation that Foucault has with music, which then sort of disappears. He knew quite a lot of composers around the Olivier Messiaen circle in the 1950s that seems to have been important to him. And then that sort of falls away. He has then later some connections to Pierre Boulez and Ercam, and that contemporary music project that Boulez directs. And then, of course, Boulez is at the Collège de France with Foucault as well. So there's a connection to music there, but that sort of falls away in Foucault's explicit mentions. He's more interested in literature and art, it seems, after that time.
Okay. So without sort of venturing too far into the history of madness, because that's not what this book's about, what sort of germs of that book can we find within this period? And if we can find some clear influences or pathways which lead into the history of madness, do they change in any drastic ways before it's published?
In some sense, that's a difficult question to answer because we don't have draft material for the history of madness. There's a few pieces in the archives that look like variants of the text or material that Foucault might have used for something following it. Foucault was an inveterate kind of promiser of a future book on a topic that never actually happened. And so there's fragments that sort of, okay, so he had actually done some work on this idea, but then he didn't elaborate and develop it. But there's not much that looks like it was written before the history of madness was completed. So there's not the ability to do with the history of madness quite what I was able to do with the history of sexuality, where I could see through lectures or through draft materials and so on, stages that the work went through where ideas became important or then fell away or reworked in a different way and so on. So I wasn't able to do that sort of really philological work with the history of madness that I might have wanted to do had there been material available. Although the book would have ended up, you know, twice the length if that had existed. There are certainly connections to Foucault's early interests. I mean, as I said, most of the early publications are on psychology. Most of his early teaching is on psychology, but framed within philosophical debates because he's teaching philosophy students about psychology. He has an extremely thorough knowledge of Freud, of debates around Freud. He was attending some of Jacques Lacan's early seminars in Paris before he moved to Uppsala and then Warsaw and Hamburg. So he clearly knew the standard debates. And so when Foucault then makes comments about psychology and particularly psychoanalysis later, whether it's in The History of Madness or in other writings, he really knew that work. He'd been teaching it for years and he continued teaching it into the 1960s. His post at Clermont-Ferrand, where he taught for about 5 years in the 1960s, was again a post in psychology. So he really knew that material. So even if he's very critical of the way that that has developed over time and the way that it has its roots back, as he says, kind of in the lazarettos of the Middle Ages, the History of Madness sort of critique of that, he really knew that material. And in some of the earlier writings, he was writing about it in a much more, in a sense, almost uncritical way, that he was explaining developments that had happened historically. So one of the early book chapters that he does publish is a survey of 100 years from 1850 to 1950 of the main developments in psychological research. So he knew that material, even if he's quite critical of it and its development and its history in The History of Madness. The literature material that he was teaching in the later 50s, there's a lot of literary references in The History of Madness, and some of those seem to have come from things that he was teaching. But it's not possible to directly say, oh, well, this passage is tied to a thing that he taught, because we don't have the material from those classes. It's more that I've been able to reconstruct some of the titles of lectures that he gave or things like that, rather than the content of them. And some of the themes that are there in the book that Foucault publishes in 1954, this is Mental Illness and Personality, which is a book he disowns, he rewrites in 1962, and then tries to kind of erase from, you know, the record. Some of that 1954 book, which talks about existential psychoanalysis, so the Binswanger type approach, talks about Marxist work, or at least Soviet work in psychology, so Pavlov. A lot of that material kind of Foucault knows, but then that completely falls away when he comes to write The History of Madness. So despite all the work I did, The History of Madness is still an astonishing work. It's not that kind of I was able to, I've described this before as kind of like you take the back off the clock so you can see how it works. I wasn't able to quite get to that point with The History of Madness. Some of it is just still, even though there's Foucault's reading notes that are preparatory to it that we have access to, and some of it is still, wow, how did he get from there to there in terms of his development? It's still an astonishingly rich book that I know I haven't exhausted what might be said about it in this study. I hope I've elucidated some of the ways it came to be, but there's still a whole lot of things in there that are really quite astonishing.
So do you think perhaps the major transition for Foucault here is that it's one where his sympathies move from sort of a clinical psychology more to a sympathy of philosophy, and this is what's happening from the 50s to the 60s?
You could put it in those ways. I suppose actually I'd probably say it's Foucault becomes a much better historian in the writing of The History of Madness, or that history becomes a much more important approach in the way that he's doing things. There is some historical sense in the publications that Foucault does in the 1950s. I said there's that 100-year survey. There's some element of sort of historical sense of developments in the Mental Illness and Personality book. But The History of Madness really is a history. Mm-hmm. It takes a much longer historical period. He does do some work with non-printed sources in archives in Paris. He uses the Bastille archive particularly. And so he becomes more interested in historical development, which is something I think that carries on throughout his work. I think the philosophy-psychology relation was there from the earliest courses and manuscripts that still exist. I suppose it's more that he becomes a real historian in the writing of The History of Madness. Now, of course, official historians, you know, sort of card-carrying historians, people who are professors of history, at the time and since have been critical of how Foucault writes histories. But there was at least an aspiration in terms of what he was doing that I think was much more historical when he comes to write The History of Madness. It's maybe worth saying that the original title of that text was not The History of Madness. History of Madness was part of its subtitle. The original French title of the 1961 text would have translated as Madness and Unreason, a history of the of madness in the classical age. And it becomes abbreviated in later reprints and, of course, in the English translation as History of Madness. But it was a book around that relation between madness and unreason and then what becomes understood as mental illness.
Okay. So outside of sort of the long time inaccessibility of a lot of this archival stuff from the 50s, do you think there have been some other reasons as to why much of this era has been forgotten or ignored?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the Dreyfus and Rabinow, sort of, you know, the one line and then we're into the history of madness. You know, the biographies, and it's important to say this, the Didier Erebon and David Macy biographies particularly were invaluable in the work I was doing. And it's not that people have never written about this period. I mentioned Elisabetta Basso's work, Philippe Sabot, who's also editing some of the early texts, has written some really important things about this. There are other works on this period. Lynn Huffer's written a fantastic book called Mad for Foucault, which is a sort of a queer theory rereading of the history of madness, or reading the history of madness as a foundational text of queer theory. And so there are some really good works that have been written about this period. I don't want to say, you know, nothing's ever been done. And so I was able to use those, and often Erebon or Macy sort of in kind of microcosm talk about something, you know, in a paragraph that I was able then to expand into a section or their section that became a chapter or something, because there is this new material. But so often their stories tell this, but in that sort of distilled form. And part of that was because they had access to people that knew Foucault. Mm-hmm. And so Erebon's writing in the late 80s, Macy a little bit later, really the early 90s. But because Foucault died at 57, it wasn't just Foucault's contemporaries that were still alive. It was also Foucault's teachers, the generation before him, that was still alive and were able to be interviewed. And so a lot of that they were able to sort of capture by oral history, by doing interviews with these people. Very few people that knew Foucault in that period are now still alive. There's a lot of people that knew Foucault in the 70s and 80s still alive, obviously, but not from the 1950s. So I was having to both use their sources, use the archival material, but I wasn't able to, you know, have a conversation with Congouin, say, about, you know, what Foucault was doing or what the nature of their relation was with Congouin as the notional rapporteur for the History of Madness thesis. And so I had to reconstruct that by going to the Congouin archive and seeing whether there was anything there that might help me to tell this story. So I suppose the other reason why it's maybe not been so discussed, the 50s in secondary literature or debates, is that Foucault clearly distances himself from so much of the material he does write in that period, that until Dier Écrit, the French collection of his short works, was published in 1994, it would have been quite hard for people to have even found the publications that Foucault did in the 50s. The book chapters, you know, those books went out of print. The Binswanger translation went out of print. His translation of Victor von Weizsäcker's Der Gestaltkreis, that went out of print. So these texts were not in wide circulation. There would have been a few libraries that had copies, but they didn't sell terribly well. I mean, I did find secondhand copies of all of these, some of which were quite expensive, but because they'd just gone out of print or they'd not sold very well in the first place. And so there was a neglect, I think, partly because Foucault distances himself from that, but also because until 1994 with Dier Écrit, they weren't widely known. These were not easy texts to find. And Foucault tries to cover up his own, or kind of cover up the trail sort of he left behind him. You know, in later interviews, The History of Madness, he always describes as his first book. I mean, it wasn't his first book, but it was his first sort of real book, or the first book he wanted to remember as part of his legacy. So he does some, you know, obscuring the traces of the history as well.
How do you think he would feel about... I think there's quite, it's happened quite a few times. I mean, Deleuze is another example of a philosopher who people are sort of going back through the archives that they explicitly mentioned, you know, I don't want to publish this stuff. How do you think they would react to this being sort of analysed?
Well, that's been a big question in terms of the Foucault publication, you know, the College de France courses, then through to the History of Sexuality, Volume 4. And other texts that have been published in the last decade or more, there is a big debate. You know, should Foucault's stipulation of no posthumous publications have been respected? I'm pretty sure that Foucault would have disliked what I've done. And, you know, to an extent, I'm okay with that. It's... we talked about the Hegel and the Kant texts that he wrote. Those were closest in terms of form to what I've done. You know, Foucault was engaging very carefully with a single thinker on the basis of the textual record, and then with Kant particularly was interested in textual variants. So the variants of Kant's anthropology book were translated in Foucault's appendix to his French translation of that text. So Foucault was interested a little bit in the textual and the variation of Kant's text. But then Foucault's later writing does quite a different way. He rarely writes a text on a single thinker in that same way in his later career. So I think he would have distanced himself from both the style of what I'm trying to do. His work was quite different in style. And he would have also probably, you know, not liked the fact that I was able to go through the papers and see this and work out this connection, or to have access to that material in the way that I have. I mean, I should qualify that by saying, you know, this is not my comparing myself to Foucault in terms of quality, but in terms of the type of work that he did and the type of work I've tried to do on him. But I mean, I've learned so much in writing, particularly the early Foucault book. Just huge parts of his career that I knew almost nothing about before I started this work. And I learned so much in writing it. I'm hoping that, you know, people will find things in reading it that help them maybe to situate all these publications that are coming. So the Binswanger text, the Phenomenology and Psychology manuscript will be published, the course on philosophical anthropology, and some other material from this early 50s period will all be published over the next few years. And maybe what I've done, along with the work that the editors do in their contextual material, you know, will help people reading that material to sort of fit those bits into a wider picture of what Foucault was doing.
Okay. Do you think there's anything key that we've missed that you'd like to mention about the book?
I don't know. I mean, you've covered a lot in terms of what you've said. I suppose the thing that was really interesting for me was in part how much I had to go to different places to piece together this story. I mean, the Bibliothèque Nationale and the big archives of Foucault's material were by far the most important. But I was able to get a small grant from the British Academy, which enabled me to go and look at Binswanger's papers in Tübingen and Kuhn's papers in Frauenfeld in Switzerland, or other Foucault papers that were in various places, or in Paris again to look at the Congrès archive, the Hippolyte archive, the Dumézil papers, and then various other places that have got little sort of, you know, one bit of evidence that was maybe worth a trip just to look at one document in an archive or something like that, and to try and piece this story together from often quite fragmentary things that were sometimes quite dispersed, but that I've tried to put back together and to tell this story. So it's, you know, I clocked up quite a lot of, not really air miles, but sort of train miles, or you know, lots of trips to Paris, but lots of trips to other archives in France, or to the ones in Switzerland and Germany. The time I spent in Sweden was important. Yale has Foucault's, a large chunk of Foucault's own personal library, which are the books that were given to him by his friends and colleagues with dedications. That helped to fill in a couple of little bits here and there. And so I suppose it was the how much real research there was in doing this, that how much of it I couldn't do either in my home study or in the Paris archive, but how much I had to travel to put this book together.
Did you obviously research the other two books? It's, you know, Foucault sort of seemed to want to keep this neat publication history, but it seems that behind this was almost a fragmentary sort of chaos, it seems, just scattered all over the place.
And that's true with a lot of his publications. I mean, the work that went into Dear Cree, this initially it was published as four roughly sort of 800 to 900 page volumes. It's since in French been published in two very long volumes, and then in English we only have a fragmentary translation of it. But one of the things that Dear Cree did, as well as bringing these sort of half forgotten texts in French back into circulation, was that it translated texts that had not been published in French in Foucault's lifetime into French. So some of those were translation from an English original. So some of Foucault's material in North America in the 1970s and 1980s was originally delivered in English. Mm-hmm. And so they translated it into French. But some of the translations in that text were translations back into French. So there was a sort of lost French original of a text that was then published in Japanese or in Brazil or other places. And then they had to translate that translation into French for Dear Cree. So Foucault gives some interesting interviews outside of France, which I imagine he thought wouldn't be read by people back in Paris, where he'll talk about things in a different way, or he'll talk about a thinker that he doesn't talk about so much in the Paris debates, because he didn't imagine that people in France would get to read it, because it was going to be published in, you know, in Arabic or in Swedish or in, you know, something, some other language. Now, of course, most of that material has come back into French in some form or other. So there was a sort of fragmentary publication history in terms of his own life, as well as the traces of material from other places that we're able to reconstruct, I think, from the archives and so on that are available.
Okay. That makes sense. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I suppose the only other thing is to say that, you know, the acknowledgements to this book are really extensive. I was amazed at how generous people were if you asked them nicely. And I owe quite a lot to people that gave me access to material that either they had in private possession or that they were able to allow me to look at things in archives. And so there's quite a lot of debts to people that I owe for this work. I also, because some of the material on Foucault was published in languages I can't read, like Swedish or Polish or Portuguese. So I used, it's the first time I've ever really done this, I used research assistants who I paid, or we paid through various Warwick schemes, to do some work where they would read things and then give me a summary of something that I thought was helpful to what I was doing. So that was important and useful for me as well. And then I'm co-editing a special issue of Theory, Culture and Society with Daniele Lorenzini and Orazio Herrera, which is on Foucault before the Collège de France, which has got pieces by most of the editors of all of these texts I've been talking about that are going to be in the next sort of tranche of publications. So they're writing about these texts that they've often been working on from the archival source to turn it into a publishable text. And with that, you know, having now seen texts in their archival form and then later seen some of them in their published form, the work those editors put into those texts is extraordinary. And it's really undervalued and underappreciated. People think that editing a book is, you know, a sort of a, it's often ranked as one of the lower forms of academic output, which is, For editing those kind of primary texts is such a disservice to the work. And so many of us owe so much to them, but also to people like Graham Birchall, who's translated so many of the Collège de France courses. That's really underappreciated academic labor. So I suppose that's the debts I have to people who helped me, and the debts that I and others have to the editors, to the translators. I think that's really important.
Okay. When do you have a date for when it's going to be published?
It's supposed to be June 2021.
Okay.
So seven or eight months away, which, given my previous experience working with Polity, that seems about right. June next year.
And that'll be through Polity's website, best place to go.
Yes. Yeah, it's not on the Polity website yet. It is, I noticed that it is available as a pre-order on the world's global bookstore. as yet, it's not on the Polity website.
Would you prefer people not to use the world's global bookstore?
Well, I mean, if there's an alternative, I realize that for all of its problems, that has made things available in ways that were, I mean, I remember back in the PhD era, the difficulty of getting hold of French texts in England, and how their French version made that so much easier when that became available. And so, it has allowed things to circulate in ways, there are alternatives, and if you can use those, then do. The problem is, of course, it has swallowed so many of those alternatives.
Yeah. And many of the alternatives. Abe Books is actually owned by them as well.
Yes, exactly.
So you never know what you're actually, who you're funding.
And Book Depository as well.
Blimey. Okay, that seems like a good place to finish up. So Stuart Eldon, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.